This week on the show, will rock melt your face off? No. How to keep your audience when you see them drop off, and why Twitter failed. All this on This Week in Media, episode 147.
Hey there, boys and girls. We are back. I am back. My voice is not quite back, but now it just sounds slightly sexy, right?
Yeah.
Right, doesn't it? I was off last week because I lost my voice for no reason. I wasn't at a concert screaming. I wasn't, you know, I didn't run into Brian Brushwood on the street where he wowed me with magic tricks.
And you just screamed it away.
Yeah, no, I just had a sore throat for a couple hours one night. And the next morning I wake up, my voice is gone. So I couldn't do Twim last week. But that's okay. We had Alex last week. We had our new regular co-host, Tim. It's just kind of, you know, Tim Street's been on the show, as you know, on and off for the last several months, and now he's official.
He's
vetted. Which doesn't really mean much, but it just means I can make him do more. I just give him more
response. There you go.
I'm your workhorse. Add that to the Google Docs. Right? Anyway, so let me tell you about our guest in studio, and then I'll introduce my illustrious co-host. Brian Brushwood is here.
Howdy.
Yeah, it's so good to do this face-to-face. You were on Twim, I think, a couple months ago.
A couple months ago.
But you were at home.
Yes, by Skype, and then we also had video troubles.
So it was a photo.
It was like a cardboard cutout of Brian.
With fire, yeah, of course.
Yeah, exactly. So now it's good to actually be here
in the flesh. On my Facebook page, I have that picture where we were at South by Southwest, and you were trying to get me to eat the fire. And on my description, it says, you know, Daisy Whitney's and whatever, a podcaster, a reporter, and you know, I host the show This Week in Media. Some of this work entails being asked to eat fire. Because I didn't actually eat the fire.
But I love the way you spazzed out and you realized that you weren't going to eat the fire, but you're still holding it and it's about to burn your fingers. Right. So you just thrust it in my face.
Right.
Like, do it.
This is when I interviewed Brian at South by Southwest for PBS. Yeah. And he was trying to get me to eat the fire, and I just jammed it at him. So he had to put it out.
It ended up being good TV either. Either way, very well done.
You know how to do it. So, for those of you who don't know, well, I don't know who could possibly not know, but anyway, Brian is the host of Scam School and a fabulous bizarre magician. Of course, we also have Alex, as always. How are you, Alex?
I am doing well.
And I don't know if you guys can tell. We should make Alex stand up. He looks amazing. Alex, as you've heard, because he talks about
you.
It. He has his iPhone app or whatever for his, you know, his weight loss and his gym program. I mean, he looks fantastic. So.
Can you actually watch the metrics real time? Of how you like?
I haven't put. I don't post it. I don't post it. No, I was tempted to when I first started. I was doing really well, and then there was a part of the desert in the middle. There's a couple months in the middle where there's this point where you lose, you know, like 20 pounds,
right?
And so you're a lot better than you were, but you're still a long way away from where you're going. And I was kind of in that middle run, and so there was like a 20 pounds that took me like 4 months to get rid. There was 20 pounds that I got rid of in 2 months, and then there was 20 pounds that I got rid of in 4 months, and now I've got another 10 or 15 pounds that I'm trying to.
You look amazing.
But now you're over the hump, man.
Well, now I'm in that final sprint. You know, like you can see it off there, and now people walk up to me and they're like, "Would you like to go out to lunch or something?" They're like, "I don't really do lunch right now. You know,
I can't have lunch anymore.
I don't do food anymore.
I can't
ever eat
again."
Well, it's just like I'm afraid to leave my safe little Nutrisystem world. And by the way, someone asked me, they didn't send me any free food, and they're not paying me to talk about it. So someone literally, I pay my $3.30 a month,
I tell you,
or whatever.
That's the worst thing is going out to eat, because like I do great when I'm at home working out and I got my little ritual and everything, and then I go out on the road for a show, and I undo a month's worth of work
And I literally have my little Nutrisystem things in my bag. There's a pack area in my bag that I keep all that stuff in, so that like when I travel, I take it all with me. Like I'm always my little safe little place.
No, you need it. And what
happens when you hit your target weight? Will you keep doing that? Are you Nutrisystem for life now, or
no.
Can you start working in
food? My next thing. I know this is not has nothing to do with media. What I now have is this new tool on my iPhone called, and I'm going to talk about it tomorrow on Mac Break, called Nutrition.
Oh, okay.
And this Nutrition menu, and it has every major restaurant. So I like walked into In-N-Out Burger going. Because I had my daughter who's visiting here she's never been to In-N-Out Burger, and so I figured I'd take her to In-N-Out Burger. It's a West Coast kind of thing. She's from Pittsburgh, and so we went. But of course, what am I going to eat? You know, in my diet, and so of course I went through In-N-Out. Yes, I just squirted some ketchup right in there. I was like, oh, that tastes great.
What did you eat there?
So I got a hamburger, mm-hmm. protein style. which is without the bun.
Right.
230 calories. But of course, it's in here. And then of course, I went to Quiznos and I got a salad. And when I left Quiznos, I was like, I didn't have my iPhone with me. I got back to the office and I put it into Quiznos and I found the salad. It's like 1,000 calories for the salad. And I just put it in the fridge and I was like, I'm not eating that. I'd rather starve than it's like, I don't care about spending 1,000 calories on. And when you start dieting, you don't spending money anymore. You're spending calories.
Yes. Yes.
So you look at it like, you know, that calorie, because I calculated that every pound has cost me, you know, there's a certain cost.
3,500 calories.
What?
3,500 calories equals a pound.
Well, but I'm talking about money. All the gear and stuff that I bought. It's like $50 a pound.
Wow.
So 3,500 calories to me is about $50.
Wow.
So, you know, a salad that is 1,000 calories in my head. Yeah, it's about
$20.
$20.
Yeah,
that's how much that costs to get rid of again.
That's brilliant.
As I converted it to that, then it gets real easy to think about, because I don't think about money. You know, money isn't. I mean, I'm not rolling in money, but I don't have an expensive palate. Like, I don't need to go to French restaurants or anything. I just go to diners. So the exact cost of stuff doesn't really matter, but the calories do.
You know, I'm not afraid to put my head in the sand when it comes to calories. After being a teenage girl with an eating disorder, I just don't care anymore. That's my feeling. Like, I had an eating disorder when I was a teenager, and I'm 37 now, and I'm just like, whatever. I don't count calories. I don't look at what anything is anymore. I just kind of decide, do I want to eat this? Do I not want to eat this? And I go run with my dog in the morning. Tim, how are you today? It's good to have you here.
I am doing well, and since you're talking about nutrition, gosh darn it, if you are a traveler, my next door neighbor actually has a podcast and a website you should check out. It's called healthyvoyager.com, and it's for people who, you know, maybe in that vegetarian, vegan space, but also just how to eat healthy while you're traveling. So check it out.
That is
important.
I'm
doing great.
No, that there is, because it is very hard to do that. My son is here today. You won't get to see him. He's off camera. Hi, Walker. Thank you for joining us. He's
waving. This is like family day.
I know,
you know.
It's family hour here at the cottage. Where are your little girls? We need to bring them in too, Ryan.
Yeah.
So I have some exciting news. But you know what? I'm going to share that at the end, because we've been chit-chatting, and I want to get into some news first, and then I'll share my exciting media news. Okay, so Tim, I want you to take the first topic. You Twittered something interesting last week. What if large media companies' web series loaded faster and played smoother than your online video? Which I think sometimes already happens, but there's some new coalition or group or something, openentertainment.org. Tell us about that. I think that sounds pretty interesting.
Sure. So the guys behind TubeFilter and the Streamy Awards have put together a new organization called the Open Entertainment Alliance. And it's basically just a coalition of film and television and web television professionals who are interested in raising awareness about public policy issues and anything that would affect our industry, with the mission really being about internet freedom and net neutrality. So,
wait, how is this related to their web series loading faster than indies?
Sure. Well, if you take a look at where media is today, about 80% of all the media that we consume comes from six companies, the six major studio network organizations. And it used to be that independent producers were part of the mix, and they've pretty much gone to the wayside right now. And so because of that, we're concerned with different things that have happened with different ISP throttling and things like that. There's a possibility that the studios could pay money to the ISPs to have their content delivered ahead of independent content.
And this happens. I mean, one of the things about this, this happens a lot, and you don't know that it's happening. So you start downloading you can download the first 25 megs I find on Comcast at about, you know, at 30 megs a second. You know, it's just incredibly fast. And then it just slows down. You know, and it doesn't, it slows down to twice the speed of T1. So it's not like they stopped it or anything, but they definitely don't give me the same bandwidth all, you know, consistently. But you go up to, you fly Virgin America, which is a great airline, and they have internet service. YouTube will stream great Like, so if I go up to YouTube and I hit those movies, they'll play back immediately. But if I go to iTunes and try to download a song or a movie or
so
whatever.
There's definite traffic shaping going on.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And this is happening all over the place.
I love the fact that the very existence of this initiative is bringing attention to the possibility of it. People don't realize the ways that that, you know, backroom deals or small decisions like, oh, we feel like this traffic's more important, can squash the innovation of you know, the new media revolution.
Yeah.
This is I'm really excited about this.
Now, is this really a little conspiracy thing at all, guys, or is this really happening?
Well, it's business sense on the side of Comcast. You know, Comcast is an internet provider, but they're also, their main business is to run TV, and it's in their interest to keep things running smoothly the way they go. Now, you know, that's not to say, and I know what you're saying, I'm not saying a secret backroom deal. I'm saying out in the open, they could just decide, you know what, we don't want to prioritize BitTorrented video traffic because we think that will hurt our interests. And then they do it, and what do you say about it? You know, how many choices do you have for your ISP? The infrastructure's
in their defense, you know, one of the things that I don't do that very often. You know, but one of the things is that, you know, I noticed that, you know, for instance, 3G doesn't work very well. AT&T's 3G doesn't work very well in San Francisco. It works in other places a lot better. And one of the reasons for that is that there's a lot of iPhone users in San Francisco, like every fourth person. And so the thing is they're all using that bandwidth, and it affects everybody. So the argument the ISP has is there is a limited bandwidth available, and we have to make sure that, you know, one person downloading 30 megs a second, or not, more importantly, not one, but 2,000 of them, doesn't suck up all the bandwidth that they have. Some people will say that's, you know, crap because they have plenty of bandwidth, but that's part of the equation that they're putting out.
Yeah, and I agree. That's why net neutrality is such a sticky situation. You know, I totally empathize with being hardcore net neutrality. If you pay for your bandwidth, you should get what you pay for, and it doesn't matter what you're doing with it. It's nobody's business. On the other hand, I'm not a fan of the FCC or the government getting involved in just about anything. So it always makes me a little bit nervous to run to the government to write a legislation saying that they have to.
And this
I'm going to become a libertarian.
Now, there is the new Internet Freedom Preservation Act that's been introduced, and I think it's going to be voted on in February. There's a couple of websites you can go to, savetheinternet.com and the openentertainment.org are two great websites. And if you forget, just go to my Twitter stream, One Tim Street on Twitter, and I've linked to them there. Also, this is a really tough issue to explain. A lot of people don't understand it, and we're trying to come up with a clear, concise message on how to explain this. You know, if you think about the telephone, there was a time when if you had AT&T and somebody else had MCI, you couldn't call them. And then the government got involved and made it so that you could call different telephone companies.
And so the hope with this, basically, in a nutshell, is that that this group could potentially protect the interests of independent producers.
Yeah, and I think that what we're not talking about necessarily is always
absolutely
the end.
Absolutely.
And we're not talking, Tim, you can correct me if I'm wrong, we're not talking necessarily about what my subscription looks like from Comcast. What we're really talking about is are they going to charge more for someone who, you know, to use get fast pipes from the server? So from the ISP's point of view, you know, if I'm a guy trying to put up MacBreak, like for instance, we MacBreak goes out of CacheFly, or and this show goes out of Libsyn. Will Libsyn and CacheFly be affected where they're not paying the $1 million a year to have access to that pipe? Is everyone going to have to wait for their content? Tim, is that the concern?
Well, it is a concern. I mean, these companies have spent, you know, millions, billions of dollars building this infrastructure, and we're paying to use it, but they own it, they spend it, they control it, and it's a free country. There are no laws in place preventing them from doing this type of stuff, and we'd like to see the internet stay the way that it is now so that we can continue to make independent content and make that available for people to watch.
Okay, so let's talk about Boxy for a few minutes, because this news last week kind of shocked me. So many of you guys might know that the Boxy just got another $6 million of venture funding, and this was on top of $4 million, I believe, that was raised late last year. And you know what the Boxy CEO Avner Ronin said to New TV, I'm quoting from the story, is that the company raised the money now to keep up with the interest in the product. Obviously, a lot of folks are talking about it. You know, in our world, the company originally thought CE device makers wouldn't be interested in Boxy until 2010, but evidently those hardware companies are a little ahead of schedule. I guess I haven't seen, as a Boxy user, a lot of improvements in the user interface since I started using it. I don't know, probably 8-10 months ago. I don't even use it that frequently because it's still very clunky. And I just haven't seen a lot of advancements in deal making after the Hulu.
Now, when you say it's clunky, are you using it on a PC or on a media box, or do you have it on your Apple TV?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you do have it on an Apple TV.
I just feel it's very clunky. And the main reason is what I found is that the menu is hidden off to the left of the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And if you didn't know that, I mean, you basically had to just kind of randomly hit the little tiny little Apple remote button to find it, and then it brings it up there.
There is a learning curve.
Yeah.
My main complaint about Boxy, and I use it on Apple TV as well, I suspect that all my complaints are related to how weak the processing power of the Apple TV is. I think if everything went real fast and it was actually had a little more horsepower for it, I think I would be ecstatic with Boxy all across the board.
Have you tried it on any other device? Have you tried it on a computer? Does it work better?
I didn't, because because by the time it came out, the Windows Alpha came out, I had already installed it on my Apple TV. So I've only used it that way. But Boxy as a CE device always seemed like a natural fit to me. And I'm surprised that their own schedule didn't have interest written down until 2010.
So is this enough to save the company? I mean, clearly this is, I mean, I don't mean the $6 million. I mean, that's a huge cash infusion, which still baffles me. But is this the future for Boxy being on consumer electronics devices?
It might be. I mean, I think that I think one of the big things, you know, in our household is the big competition. The thing that's taken over the house as far as watching stuff is the Roku. You know, Roku.
That's the Netflix box.
Yeah,
yeah. That's for us. It's the Xbox 360. We use the Netflix streaming all the time. It was one of the best services out there.
I mean, Netflix is the killer app. I mean, right now, because you're paying, you can take it down to one disc a month, right?
Right,
and you can get the instant play, and so you're paying $10 a month,
which is what we do, right. and have done since the first day.
I used to be at very high numbers at Netflix, you know, like eight at a time, because I was watching stuff all the time, and everything was great. And then I moved down to three, and now I'm moving down to one because all we use is instant play now, and it's not as high resolution. But when we want a high resolution, when we want to really sit down and watch a movie, I can rent from Amazon Unbox. I can rent it
on the Roku, right?
On the Roku,
it's impressive Roku's deal making ability. I mean, the service launched, I think, about a year ago with Netflix from the beginning, and added Amazon recently. I mean, such huge companies to have deals with.
And I've been traveling. I came back and I hit it, and I saw Major League Baseball beta.
And that's,
I was like,
on Roku.
Wow, yeah.
And Boxy has that. That's one of the few deals that Boxy does have. Earlier this summer, signed a deal with MLB.tv. MLB has probably been the most forward-thinking of the sports leagues in terms
NFL
of offering its content.
And what I want to see is what the NFL has been doing on the Flash platform with some of their Sunday Night Football games, where you can watch multi-angles. You can
watch the
whole thing.
I tried one out. It looks good.
Yeah, and that...
I hate football, though.
If that got into... If that leaked itself into something that we could see on a Roku or on Boxy, I think that would change a lot of things, because now we're actually able to have interactive features.
Right. Now, one thing I did want to say about Boxy as a CE device, I honestly don't see the point of Boxy on a computer, because if you're on a computer, you have a keyboard, you have a mouse. The beauty of Boxy is the ease of the interface. And if you want to measure the intensity with which people are excited about a CE device, just go to the Boxy forums and look at how hard people are working on making Apple TV work as well as possible with Boxy. I mean, there are just pages and pages of forum posts and all these minor tweaks to get better performance. I think Boxy as a CE device is a foregone conclusion. I don't even see the point of doing anything else.
And then, so then maybe that's the key to who cares if they have Hulu then, right?
Well, no, I mean, I think Hulu integration is very important, and I think the Boxy should continue to fight for that and work with it. But I think the reason Hulu should be on Boxy is so that I can watch it in my living room.
Yeah, I'm all for that. Let's go vote for Brian's living room. Interesting story. Actually, speaking, you know what? Let's talk about Netscape for a minute, because as we're talking about who's backing what. So a story in the New York Times recently that Marc Andreessen, who's the founder of Netscape, he's backing a startup called Rockmelt. Now, he's a VC now. Not a lot of details on it, but Rockmelt is a new internet browser. And yeah, so I can't really tell you much about what it's supposed to look like. If you guys know any more, feel free to weigh in.
All I'm
but this
say,
is supposed to be the you know, the newest browser. I don't know.
I'm just, thank goodness we got a new browser, because between Internet Explorer, Chrome, Firefox, Safari, and Opera, I just, you know, I'm just feeling very constricted. I got to get out of here.
What do you use?
I use Firefox.
Okay.
I use Firefox. But I tell you what, I may switch to Rockmelt just for that badass name. It's like
it's the
face melter. Hotter than lava.
So who's going to use it? I mean, who even uses Chrome? I mean, there are some, I've been to some websites that just look horrible in Chrome. And that's because I think that the people behind them aren't aware that there is this other browser. I know that probably Chrome usage is very minimal, but it's still frustrating when something doesn't work that well. I mean, that's my default browser now, and I really like it. So I can't imagine having to add yet another one to design for.
I find that I, as someone who has to have a company online, I just bang my head on the screen every time I see a new one.
A new browser, new troubleshooting.
Like, you know, and that's why we're moving. We started moving a lot of stuff to Squarespace, because I was just like, I'm just going to have them figure it out.
Yeah.
I'm just going to hand it to them.
I did the exact same thing.
They're not a sponsor of the show today. We wish they were.
But we've already established we love them.
We love them. And the thing is, I'm just going to let them figure it out, because it's just, you know, let the cloud sort that out, because I can't take it anymore.
Now, there was one promising thing I read in the article, was that it was the idea. He said, look, a lot has changed. Pretty much every browser out there is still doing the exact same thing that it did when it was developed, you know, when we were using them in the mid 90s. And there's a lot that's changed about the way we use media and the way we use the internet. What would it be like if you rebuilt the browser from scratch today? And, you know, who knows? Maybe it's good that they're keeping their mouth shut. Maybe they're going to come up with something, a big surprise out of nowhere, in which case, you know, that'd be great. More power to them. But for right now, I'm with you guys. It's like, wow, that sure is another headache.
Right, yeah.
Of course, now I will say, I just want to be fair. I'm trying to be fair today. I don't know why.
It's a change of pace for you.
I know, exactly. So, yeah, just to be fair, one of the things I have to say is that when Google came out, I was like, why? Why? I Yahoo everything. I don't, true, you know, like, it was just like I don't even know why these guys are
bothering.
So that's
the question. Is this going to be Google or Wolfram Alpha? That's the question.
Wait, what was that?
Wolfram Alpha, the new search engine, they rag, it's going to change everything. Everything will be cataloged and super simple.
Or
and everyone's
Bing.
Like, well, it does
but
my
now,
math
okay,
homework.
But so here's the question. And Tim, I'll throw this one to you. Bing is getting a lot of buzz. And this was mentioned in the story that, okay, and I'm not saying Bing is going to be,
you love,
you know,
Bing.
I'm embarrassed to admit I've never even used it. So I haven't even tried it, but I know it's obviously getting a lot of buzz. People are talking about it. And that was sort of referenced in the story, that the idea that, okay, well, now after, you know, Google's dominance, there's another one that's getting some action. You know, could the same thing happen with Rockmelt?
Face melt.
Well,
let's let Tim weigh in.
Tim?
Well, you know, I like Bing and all of his movies that he did with Bob Hope. Those were really, really good movies. I wish they'd get back together, you know? You know, on a less serious note, I was hanging out with some college kids, and they told me about this new web browser that they were using. It's called Facebook, and it's amazing. You can talk to all your friends on it.
Yeah,
it's crazy. And it works,
that's going to be a big deal.
And evidently, watching my daughter this weekend, I found that Facebook works very well on an iPhone. So
What doesn't work well on an iPhone?
Except the portable.
I'm just saying there's a portable nature. I really think that Facebook is going to have a major impact on all new browsers. I think that, you know, you look at Facebook and you go, well, I can do all this stuff on my computer. I don't need Facebook. And you need Facebook when you don't have a computer, when you're in college and you're at somebody's place and you don't have your stuff with you. That's why you need Facebook. But as we move forward, the things that we like about Facebook and we like about Twitter, I think those are going to come into play in our browser. And whoever has those elements built into the browser in a way that's organic, the way that Facebook is organic to a lot of people, that's who's going to take over as a leader in the browser space.
Well, and I love seeing, and I find that I am picking and choosing a little bit too. I mean, like with Bing Travel is awesome. So that's the one thing. So someone sent me, oh, you should check out Bing Travel. And so someone was going to fly. We were going to fly one of our people in from Toronto, and she emailed me and said, you know, it's $900 a flight or whatever. And I went up to Bing Travel and it's a little graph. I just said, I'm coming from YYZ to SFO. And there's a little graph and it shows you here are all the prices. Here's the lowest price. And you see this graph and then you see it drop off. And there's like 4 days that you can get a ticket that it's down here and then it goes back up again for whatever reason. But it has all these, it's figured that all out for you. And I was like, yeah, let's just fly on those 4 days.
That's awesome.
You know,
that's the cool functionality.
Oh my goodness. I mean, I was just, it was revolutionary when it comes to, you know, being able to fill that stuff in. And it looks pretty. Microsoft actually made something that looks pretty. Aww. I'm so proud of them.
That's
They've
so
come
lovely.
So far.
Hey, can you I know, let you guys...
Another quick thing about Bing that I haven't seen anyone really talk about is if you go to MSN.com and you click on video, instead of going to MSN videos like it used to, it goes to Bing.com/videos. So I feel like they've cannibalized a lot of their own traffic to give Bing more traffic.
That may make sense in the short term. If they feel like it needs a boost to get ahead, you know, that may be a conscious decision to get it feet off the ground.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think it was a mistake.
You figured out the hole in the time space Microsoft continuum. Hey, so guys, I'm going to let you handle the next story about Britney Spears and her line of branded virtual goods on Facebook, because I just want to make sure that my son, who has escaped from here, is not making Colleen and Dane crazy. All right? So I'm going to let you guys handle that story. I'll pop back in a minute. I was going to say your daughter.
So we just lost Daisy. Here we go. Hello.
Our host is gone. Oh my gosh, what are we going to do?
The lunatics are running the asylum.
So now we're just like, okay.
Alex, tell me about some new gadgets, man.
Okay, so
that red camera? We can talk about the red
camera. So I was thinking that I was driving down the one, and I thought maybe it'd be really good to have a Scarlet, but I didn't have one.
Yeah.
That's all I...
When are they coming?
It's a new red camera. The new red camera. I think the new red camera is. See, Daisy walks away, and we immediately go into geek mode.
Told you to talk about Facebook, you geeks. Now,
we don't know anything about Facebook. That's what you're supposed to talk about. You know, we talk about.
Then you should
red
keep
cameras.
Geeking out, because people tell me that they still want more geek outs on the show. So keep going. And nice. I'll just kick
that'll
back and listen.
Soon. That'll come soon enough. But you know, I hope the red camera's coming out soon. The new red. We're not buying one right now because we use it a lot. We rent it a lot. But we're not going to buy one until the new one comes out.
What do you use for your show, Brian?
To run the video stuff, or what do you mean? Which aspects? Which show?
Camera.
I got a lot of shows.
No, Scam School?
The video
what do you use
for
all
scam
of
school?
Them? Our listeners want to know.
The video camera for Scam School, I actually don't even know, because for that show, I write and I host, and Revision 3 handles all the production, which is awesome. I can be... stupid.
That's the point,
and not know anything.
Do they give you your own trailer? Do you get your own trailer?
yeah, it's called a dank barroom bathroom where I get to change next to the vomit and the graffiti scrawled on.
That's not that he's
awesome.
Bitter.
Hollywood treatment.
Do you memorize, how much of it do you write in advance, or do you just kind of sketch what the topic is going to be?
I practice the effect a lot, and I interact with people enough that I kind of have bits of business I know I could go into, but that's the tough thing. I'm so jealous. Everyone else at Revision 3, they have teleprompters. They get to write their material in advance. They have a controlled environment. I go into a dark bar with terrible lighting, a whole bunch of noise, and a bunch of people who've been drinking, and then I try to show them a trick, teach them how it's done, and then I do my stand-ups all just, you know, off the top of my head. So,
but yet
so
your
thank
show,
you. Thank
yet,
you for reminding me.
But your show has not
is.
Been canned like some of the teleprompter-based shows at Revision 3.
That is true. So there that you is go. True. I
and
have that
Dignation
going
for me. Is not scripted.
Correct.
Those guys
are just
are
talking
totally off the top of their heads.
Except for when you can clearly tell they're reading from their sponsor reads.
Right, which is important. Now, how long does it take you to shoot an episode? Like, how many takes are there, because you're dealing with those live elements of drunk people?
It depends on what kind of environment we have. And sometimes we'll do a bit and we'll just get people who are just a dud. You know, they're like, oh, you're more interested in screwing this up than doing the actual effect. But barring that, if we have good performances and stuff, we're usually able to bang out 4 in one night.
That's
so
great.
I come in, we spend 2 nights. For example, if you're in the San Francisco area tonight and tomorrow, Monday and Tuesday, we're going to be at 21st Amendment in some karaoke bar, which will be interesting.
And people can just come by.
Please come by. We really do grab just random people, random fans, mm-hmm. and get them on the show.
I want to see how many people we can drive there tonight and tomorrow with the power of Twim.
Let's see.
Whoever is in San Francisco and watching this show today, tell everybody, what was it, 21st Amendment?
21st Amendment tonight.
What time?
Starting at, I believe, 5:30 till around 10:30 we'll be shooting.
So Twitter that. Anybody who's watching right now, tell all your friends in San Francisco. Let's do our little scam school social experiment. See how big of a live audience. Brian's like, I'm never coming back in your show again. You had two people.
Yeah,
two
exactly.
Two people showed up.
Yeah, you got to be careful of swinging out there. Sometimes you hit a home run, sometimes you strike out.
But you know what? This actually, let's jump to another topic, because now that we're kind of talking about production values, you know, new TV, I get a lot of my stories from there, but they do a good job. Did an interesting story. Making Lemonade makes the, I love this title, Making Lemonade makes the best out of low production values. That's actually a show, but I just love the whole Making Lemonade analogy. Anyway, I just thought it was kind of, we don't have to go into that specific article, but it was just kind of a good jumping off point. To give some tips on production values and saving costs. I know we talk about that somewhat regularly, but that's just, you know, as I get feedback on the show from listeners, I always want to hear more on that. Now, Brian.
Yes.
I know Revision 3 is not your show to produce. I mean, you're the host and the star, and they coddle you and all of that.
They tickle my feet.
But for the so lovely. But for other shows, what would your, you know, I'm just kind of throwing this at you now. What would your top three tips be that you've learned for other independent producers just kind of to implement or think about?
You're talking about somebody who's developing independent content and wants to develop it from scratch?
Develop it from scratch, yeah. Just anything on production values, you know, time-saving tips, money-saving tips.
I tell you, one thing that I think that Revision 3 has done very, very well is recognize the importance of not doing what every other movie or television studio does, where it's like, well, of course we buy, you know, this equipment that's $30,000. But Revision 3 was just like, you know what? If we grab these two $1,000 parts, we can accomplish the same thing, and nobody's going to know that we save that $28,000. And so they're able to get a very professional look that stands apart from the crowd. And that is very important nowadays, when we're all competing with YouTube, where some 16-year-old with a webcam can get, you know, 5 million hits for a goofy rant, then it's important, if you want to play a different game, you need to look like you stand apart from that crowd. Remember, it's you want to be as different as everything else out there. And that's something I think Revision 3 has done very well. Another thing I think Revision 3 is brilliant at is their anytime, anywhere distribution. They don't care how you see the show, whether you watch it on the Flash player, whether you watch it on TiVo, whether you download it on iTunes, whether or not you watch it on YouTube or anything else. And all they need to do is count the views and total it up with a sponsorship. So all of that, I think they've done very well.
And that whole way that Revision 3 counts is, I think it's pretty impressive, you know, at least from the conversations I've had with Jim. And I think the company just is a good example. He's very adamant about counting total views. He can give you, you know, sort of all views, which includes, you know, partial views, but he also can get, you know, give you, I mean, advertisers, here are the total views, meaning a show was watched to completion. And that, I think, is just important because it speaks to engagement and interest and the passion level of the audience, that they're not just going to watch the first 2 minutes of your 10-minute episode.
The tools are even better. And this is why in the near future, I think you're going to see more and more premium rates charged for online content, because you can actually track every single click, every drag, every pause, every skipping over a sponsor read using, I think, TubeMogul's product is Illuminix, where literally you can watch a graph that shows when people are skipping over. And in fact, we actually changed the way we shot Scam School episodes, because we noticed that you drop 10% at the beginning for all the people who started and say, oh no, this isn't what I wanted. Then maybe we're 85%, and then during the trick, and then we'd still be at 85% for the reveal of the trick. And then by the time we came to the sponsor, it would drop down to like, you know, 20%.
So what do you do now?
What we do now is now we do the intro, we do the trick. Before we give the answer, we say, let's talk to the sponsors.
Brilliant.
And all of a sudden, we're keeping 80% of the entire audience. And all these numbers, I'm just making up the top of my head. But that's the general feel. Yeah. We're mainly keeping way more people as a result of shaping the content to please the sponsors without necessarily sacrificing content.
That's really
smart. And I know that when we were doing some of the shows we were doing with On Networks, which, you know, has a player that keeps track of a lot of that stuff as well, it changed the way we did our shows, because you would and what was fascinating was is that you could see that drop at the beginning. Mm-hmm. You'd always see that, like, oh, I'm in the wrong show, or this isn't what I expected, or whatever. And that was more seen as a marketing issue. You know, the name or the sell point or whatever it was. When you see that big drop, when you saw a really big drop, it wasn't the show's fault. It was it was how you sold the show.
That was when you decided to stop calling every episode "Sexy Women Click Here."
Exactly. Okay, yeah. Good. And so then you, but when you saw that, one of the things you'd see is it would get to some point and where it would drop off, and if it had a slow, gradual like slope, you just knew it was a bad show.
Yeah.
Because it was just people, just one after another, people would go, I just can't go any further. Or you'd see the host say something and suddenly it dropped. And we've had a couple times where the host said something goofy, and for whatever reason there was a hump right there. And so you could look back, that data is unbelievable, because you go back and you look at it and you suddenly get what's working and not working about your episodes. One of the things we did is we shortened our episodes a lot, because we realized that, you know, it was just it, and a lot of this comes down to what I tend to call information density. So, you know, when you watch something like ER, it's very, very dense material. Now, they're paying $200,000 a finished minute to get that really dense material.
Wow.
So that's why you can watch a 45-minute show on your iPhone or on your BlackBerry or whatever, is because it's dense material.
Dense with what? Do you mean visually?
There's lots of edits. There's great lighting. Okay. There's good writing. There's like all the things that go into it. Well, but highly produced. It doesn't, you know, and sometimes you can have something that's highly produced that is not dense, and that's their fault. But the, you know, like for instance, even a reality show is somewhat dense. There's a lot of editing. The editing makes it denser. You know, they take a lot of information. When you take, you know, 200 hours or 500 hours or 1,000 hours, and you edit it down to a reality show, a footage, you end up with this a denser piece. Now, for us as independent producers who don't have a lot of money, one of the things we have to do is when the longer we make that show, when we make it 10 minutes, 15 minutes, you know, 20 minutes long, keeping it dense all the way through is a challenge.
Alex, I love this concept. What I want you to do is give a specific example for, you know, producers listening to the show. Say they're going to produce a series of how-to videos on hot sauce. Okay, just to kind of take ones we've talked about.
Oh, thank goodness. I've been waiting for this episode. Go right? on. Yes.
Okay.
Go.
So how do they make a two-minute how-to video on hot sauce dense, information dense?
Well, I think one of the things that you do is you can play a lot when you really want. One of the things that can increase density is not use a single camera that's just locked off. So, and there are two different ways to go. There is the single camera film style, which is what we did. If you go to like Food Science, if you do a search on iTunes for Food Science, that may look like it's a bunch of different cameras. It's one camera. You know, there's one camera that we moved around for every shot. And we planned it all, but we planned it all out. Like, we're going to have a high shot here and a medium shot here and a close shot here and a wide shot here. I mean, Kiki would say four words past the edit.
Right.
You know, to keep her inflections correct. But outside of that, it was all just all the cuts and everything else that we did was all planned. And so that's one way to do it, to keep things moving. You know, and we're giving you the angle you want to see. When she's doing something with her hands, we're close to, you know, we've got the perfect angle. And one of the nice things about doing what you would call a single camera shoot, which is how a lot of films are shot, is that you design every angle. So you're not just like hand holding it and hanging on. You literally go, I'm going to have a camera, I'm going to do this part, and then I'm going to have the camera here. Now, you can also do two camera shoots where you have, and by the way, when I say these multiple camera shoots, it doesn't have to be two big broadcast cameras. It's going to be two little HV20s. I mean,
that's one of the nice things. Like, literally, I did an entire season of what we called Brian Brushwood on the Road. It was the first podcast series I did. 22 episodes, 5 to 7 minutes each. And we did the entire thing only on two $200 photo snap cameras, because the native resolution was 320 by 240, which was exactly what it would play at on an iPod at the time. As a result, everyone watching it on their iPod, it looked as professional as anything else out there.
Right. And you literally, when I'm saying multi-camera, you could use a flip, you could use an HV20, you could use any of these things. But having those multiple cameras allows you to, you could set one up. So you have one that's like the close camera where their hands are going to go, and then you have the other one. The advantage of that is it's harder to set it up. It's easier when you edit it, because you can just cut between
way
them.
Way easier.
Because when you plan it.
It gives you so many options being able to cut. If you just have one static shot, it is virtually impossible to do time dilation and to condense everything down. You can't, unless you're going to do like obviously a fast forward effect or something like that, there's no way to speed things up. But when you have just one other camera angle and you could cut back and forth, you could take 7 minutes of content and shrink it down to 3 minutes, and it's very tight and very dense.
Well, and you can get around problems. Oh, this didn't work. Or, oh, let me try that again. All that stuff can be.
There's a few things you guys are leaving out, though, here.
Yep.
You know, it's important when you're doing an independent project to take a look at your own inventory. What do you have around your house? What do you have around your workplace? What can you take advantage of? Instead of trying to make it look like a million-dollar show, think organically. What can you take advantage of and in an organic way make that work? Then on top of that, how can you make it emotionally contagious? How can you have two or more emotions pop up inside? Can you make it funny? Can you make it sexy? Can you make it scary? What are the basic human emotions that you can work into whatever you're creating? And then after you're doing all this, think outside the box. If you take a look at a show like You Suck at Photoshop, that show doesn't really use a camera. It's a screencast of what's happening on a guy's desktop. I mean, think about that for a second.
Yeah.
Okay, so wait, so what's the example to be learned from that show, Tim?
Well, you don't need cameras to do a show.
Well, and I think the other thing to be taken is that the host and the writing, like everything else, is very important.
Right.
You know, like, so when you're thinking about it, one of the things that we spend an enormous amount of energy looking for, I mean, I have this kind of, every person I'm talking to, there's something in the back of my head, like, are they going to be a good host? you know, like are they going to be, you know, because, man, that is so hard to find. It's
right.
So hard to find someone who is able to technically understand the information that you want to convey, and someone who is going to look good on camera. They're going to, and I don't mean they look like a model, but they look good on camera,
right?
You know, and they can express themselves, and they're interesting, and those things are, you know, very, very difficult to find.
Specifically, I think Tim really hit on it with the example of You Suck at Photoshop, because there has to be an emotional or a personal hook of some type. And in the case of You Suck at Photoshop, it's the comedy, but it's also the deep anger that this guy is feeling the entire time. Film, and this is for a how-to project, that brings in an element that you almost never see in a dry how-to tutorial that all of a sudden makes it engaging and sucks you in. Film Riot does the same thing with comedy. They start every episode with a 2 to 3 minute genuinely hilarious sketch.
Wait, what show?
Film Riot is the new show on Revision 3, where they show the tips and techniques to make movies look as good as you see on the television on virtually no budget, and they start each one with a genuinely hilarious sketch, and then they go back and actually show you bit by bit, and he shows very, very fast the how-to part, but he's told me, Ryan Connolly said, if I have to choose between the comedy suffering and the tutorial suffering, the tutorial will always suffer, because it's important. The comedy is the hook that keeps people engaged. It's the personal thing that makes the show hopefully a big hit.
Yeah.
That sounds similar to Next New Networks, Indie Mogul, Backyard Effects.
Yes, it is. They have been compared. Indie Mogul, I think,
What's
does a lot of... Indie Mogul, and I've only watched a couple of Indie Moguls, but Indie Mogul does a lot more hands-on analog effects, whereas Film Riot does a lot of After Effects, digital.
Yeah, yeah, production. No, that's right. Because from the episodes I've seen of Backyard Effects, it's sort of, you know, how to make the barber chair from Sweeney Todd, you know, Sweeney Todd the movie and things like that, which is more of actual special effects instead of visual effects.
Correct.
Have I had a chance yet to say the ending of Harry Potter 6, the movie sucked? I'm going to say that now. Okay. Just was thinking.
So it was pointed out to me by an expert that evidently there was a huge battle scene that was missing.
I was so disappointed. I know it's 4 weeks after the film's release, but
you're talking about it was in the book but didn't make it in the movie.
Yes, and it basically,
and it's not like a little detail.
It's not a little detail. It was everything that Draco Malfoy had been doing for the entire book was made just nullified by the fact that there was actually no battle. That's why he had been doing everything. Sorry if I spoiled it for you people. It's been out for 4 weeks, so the statute of limitations is off now. Everything that he had been doing in the book to build up for this, all of his little secret things and going into the Room of Requirement and building a tunnel to let the Death Eaters into Hogwarts was because they were supposed to have a battle. And all they did was just show up. He let them in. They're there on the tower.
I'm sure it'll show up at the beginning of the next one because, you know, they're splitting the last book into two movies.
This one was
already too late.
Yeah.
They can't go back and have
they
battle?
Couldn't. Did you see the movie?
Anyway, yeah.
Okay. All right. Anyway, sorry. I was just
the
thinking about the
really good.
They were amazing. I have to say the cave scene was amazing. My sister-in-law was in charge of that.
Tim's forget this. I'm out of here.
Well, I have to admit that my new rule has really, and I'm sure I'm going to get a lot of email for this, but so like I watch when I go to movies, to me, and I might have said this in the last show, that I see documentaries and anything that if I look at the trailer and it doesn't look like it's going to be visually arresting, mm-hmm. and I mean great cinematography or special effects, I'm going to rent it.
Yeah,
you know, like I'm not gonna spend $12, and I'm not gonna go deal with kids, and I'm not gonna deal with, you know, like I'm not gonna deal with all
this.
I have a 60, you know, whatever. I have a big screen at home. I can sit there and watch it. I don't need to go to the theater for that. So the only thing I go see are effects films, and I don't go to see them necessarily for the story. I mostly go to see them because it's a big event, and right. I'm gonna go see it, and I'm not gonna get to see that later. That's the one thing I can't do is see some of these great. Someone spent a lot of money, made it very dense.
I kind of want to see.
Alex, you couldn't even bring yourself to
say the
dense.
Word great. these very expensive films.
No, it's like, it's my job. You know, it's like, this is my industry. I go to, and I don't watch all of them. I mean, there's some of them that I just can't bring myself to go see. But
you didn't see The Hangover?
No, I haven't.
It had good special
Hangover.
Effects. They were awesome.
The Hangover?
Yeah. It really looked like he was missing that tooth. It was unreal.
Yeah, I'm waiting for that one to come in.
All right. So Alex has standards when it comes to movies. There you go.
Low
I know
standards.
It's shocking everyone that he's got some rules.
Standards.
Okay, so let's talk about celebrities messing up life for the rest of us. Okay, so they messed up Twitter, right? Coming onto Twitter, messing it up. So people like Martin Sargent and Kevin Rose could no longer at the top of Twitter. Yeah, go ahead. You want to talk?
I just want to say one thing is that I think that issue that Twitter has mm-hmm. combined with a poor infrastructure are going to be when we look back and say why Twitter failed. I'm going to say this as a past tense because it will.
Okay. Wow, you heard it here first.
No, the reason
you say that about Google.
Yeah.
No.
Google's a fad.
Bing.
It'll be out of here in no time.
but the thing is the reason I think the reason Twitter failed was because they didn't fix their infrastructure when they were small. That was number one. Mm-hmm. And now they're just, it's going to continue to be a problem.
You're talking about
grow.
Specifically with the trouble they're having with the DDoS attacks.
Well,
24 hours
and the whole thing is, if it feels like it feels better now, mm-hmm. but oftentimes, you know, that kind of stuff, it still feels like it's put together with paperclips, you know? And the other thing is that this whole thing, when they did all those recommendations and they pushed people into these hyper millions, there's two problems. One is you took everybody who worked really hard and was dedicated to you and you screwed them. I mean, you know, when you're talking about the Kevin Roses and more important, like the Leo Laportes,
right?
And you have, you know, Scoble moving all of his Twitter to his fan page on Facebook. You have, you know, Leo would go somewhere else if he could. He constantly talks about Friend Feed. And this is the core, because here's the thing that I was talking to somebody who has about 800,000 followers. You know, they were recommended.
Not Justine.
And so someone that nobody that
it's the guessing
okay.
game.
Right.
No, so there's only a handful of them. But right. anyway, the point is he had about 700,000 or 800,000. He had about 700,000 or 800,000 followers, and we were talking about penetration rates. Penetration rates. You know, how many people, like, if you do a Bitly, because a lot of us now, you know, use Bitly so that you can figure out.
You can see that.
Just so you know what the penetration rate is. Yeah. My penetration rate typically oftentimes runs around 10%.
10% right here?
Yeah, 10%.
I check every time I do a twit pick.
I'm just curious. I'm just curious what people think. And if it's higher than that, I go, wow, people really like that. And I'll think about when I see that somewhere else, I'll think, oh, that's something I should recommend because people dig that. So I get about 10%. He was talking about he gets 0.5% or less.
Wow.
Because what happens is
they're not real followers.
They're not real followers. And so what they have is they have this huge pile of fluff.
Yep.
But it is demoralizing for the little guys who used to be big.
Used to be meaningful. And now
Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has 800,000.
No, it wasn't Arnold. Me and Arnold were talking about weightlifting, and then we got into Twitter.
You know what cracks me up too? I do read Us Magazine, Us Weekly, and I'm not afraid to admit it. It was a gift for my husband for the holidays. He loves celebrity news, and I found it's really quite a delight to read every single week. And now they just because it's
very
like,
courageous of you to admit
for your
this.
Brain, right? It's just candy for your brain. Oh man, the fashion police, those are great. Okay, but anyway, they quote constantly from celebrities' Twitters, from celebrities' tweets.
Are you kidding? That's a gold mine.
I know, but
it's just
so
like, you know
annoying.
How hard it is to get celebrities to say something stupid on camera, and now they're doing it on purpose in a written format.
It just cracks me up. So and so, MC Hammer, Twittered last week about how he's blah, blah, blah. Anyway.
But anyway, okay. So all I just want to finish. The one thing is just that I just think that they're going to have a lot of trouble because they, and I've now guaranteed that I'm never going to be recommended. Sorry. So anyway, but the thing is that I really got that I would much rather be myself on Twitter and have whoever follows, yep, and not have some crazy big number and not feel like
if it's meaningless, if it's got a 0.01% penetration, I mean, that's worse than direct mail.
Well, it's not even that. I have to admit, I don't really look at, someone was asking me about the business of Twitter and I'm like, I don't know. I share whatever's on top of my head and then whoever wants to watch that or not. And some days I lose more people than I gain. And, you know, actually a lot of days I lose more people than I gain. As I said, it's just one of those things that I think some people make it too much and make it more than it is. And I think that so much of it is all fluff because people sign up to Twitter, they start following a whole bunch of people that were recommended, and then they don't understand why anyone uses Twitter, and then they stop.
Right.
You know, that's what's really happening.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I was waiting because it's a two-way street. Not only is it a bum deal for the people who have the supposed million followers and get a 0.3% penetration rate, but it's also a bum deal for the million people who signed up. You're like, oh, I heard Twitter's so great. And they sign up, and they're like, the hell, this is noise on my cell phone now.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, then you have, and then they signed up to these people who were recommended they sign up people who were recommended, and then the other problem that you get into now is that those people stop Twittering, or they don't Twitter very often,
or they're
not tweeting
about things you care about. I mean, that's the thing. Inane. That's why you follow a certain number of people. That's why you pick and choose who you follow, because they post things that are interesting but that matter to you. I mean, think that just because, and this is not against celebrities, but just because someone's recommended, that doesn't mean it's going to have any value to you, Alex, or me, Brian, or me, or Tim.
Right.
You know, I mean, it should be a personalized service. That's the whole point. But I was just going to tie this in a little bit to Facebook, because Britney Spears, according to this paid content article, has launched a line of branded virtual goods on Facebook, and they're $2 gifts, like little profile badges, like birthday cakes. So she has nearly 2 million fans, so she could theoretically generate, you know, well over $1 million in revenue. And I just wonder, is this, are we going to see,
you're going to see
like
so
e-commerce
much
now on Facebook in a way where in the same way we've seen Twitter kind of be infused. I mean, I know obviously a lot of celebrities clearly have had fan pages and whatnot and have been using Facebook already, but is this kind of the new
This is the ringtone style monetization of celebrity. Just like the music industry has seen a significant decrease in the number of albums sold, but they're seeing new revenues come in from things like ringtones, where they already have the song, but they don't mind spending 99 cents for the ability to have that song appear when somebody calls. This is somebody taking their celebrity and translating it into free money with these virtual goods. And if you want to know how powerful this can get and the direction it's going to head, just look at World of Warcraft, where virtual goods are no laughing matter. There's gold farms, there's people who have been arrested for stealing virtual goods. There have been real crimes that occurred because
arrested? Virtually arrested.
Assaulting people for their virtual goods and really being arrested over them. So I think definitely if we're going to see that spill into anywhere, this seems like the beginning. I mean, this is the beginning now, but then eventually when all of a sudden you have the next wow killer or whatever it is, you get these, maybe a Britney Spears designed dress that's only available for $10 in game on whatever. This is a huge market that's just going to explode as more online, both video games and some people have called Facebook the number one massively multiplayer online video game, because it kind of is, in that we all have these little avatars and that we interact with each other and play games within games. It's this virtual space, and I think virtual objects are going to sell for a lot in the future.
Wow. What do you think? I mean, I know you'd never buy one, but...
Well, I think that when I started playing with Second Life, when I started doing tests, I started thinking, you know, this would be a really good business to build people's houses and build extra shirts for them and build their new character, their new avatar. I could definitely see how that had a lot of value. The problem that I had is that the modeling interface was so bad that I was just like, no, I'm not going to bother. And so I kind of went away from letting people who were crazy about it do it. But I think that definitely people want it, needing virtual goods. So the thing I have to admit is that I buy virtual goods all the time. Mine are different than everybody else's. No. I probably spent $100 on virtual goods. I bought a 3D magnifying glass. I bought a set. I bought a bunch of, you know, because we do graphics for these companies, right. And those virtual goods are just as real to us
pre-rendered, pre-built, 3D modeled.
So if it take, you know, the magnifying glass would take me about an hour or two to model at that level. Or I can buy it for $25. You know, boom, done. You know, the set would cost me $3,000 to you know, if I was going to hire an artist to make it, or I can pay $141. Done. You
but
know,
it's and, kind and so, of more like buying software.
It
it's
is,
sort of the
but,
equivalent
but,
of something that exists
not,
digitally.
I'm just saying that people are doing this for fun too. What I'm
sure,
doing
okay.
and what they're doing are the same
You're
thing.
You're doing it for business. This is for fun.
They have something. It further expresses what they want to express, and it just happens to be that I have to do it professionally. But I've been, you know, we buy this stuff. You know, iStock Photo and Turbo Squid and all of these companies. Are, you know, that's what they sell. They sell virtual goods, and we, you know, we want to, you know, and they're doing the same thing. It's just for fun.
You know, and it's you mentioning that, and I don't know why I didn't even notice this, but what you mentioning that is exactly what magicians do in my business is we sell secrets. And it's not even, you know, these are not patentable, they're not copyrightable, but it's like, I will tell you where to put your pinky in order to hide the card at this moment if you give me $50. And we do that all the time.
Right. So that means
where does that happen? Like on streets,
there's a secret
alleys,
black market
right.
of magicians. We all wear pointy hats and we
capes
and our
wands. So it
nice.
Won't happen at 21st Amendment tonight. We're not going to be able to see
There'll
magician
be no pinky.
Secrecy.
Only one way to find out.
Yeah, that's right. You got to show up. It's sort of like a virtual tour, but it's real, so it's not really. Okay, so Glenn Beck lost some advertisers for calling Obama a racist. Geico has pulled ads from Fox News Channel's The Glenn Beck Program, lawyers.com, which is owned by LexisNexis, has also vowed not to advertise during the program, according to Color of Change, an African-American online political organization that has been spurring advertisers to stop supporting the show. Obviously, I'm reading from this Hollywood Reporter article. P&G, Progressive Insurance, others just have expressed concerns about their ad placements. You know, I guess you have to be careful what you say on TV because it could tick off your advertisers.
Well, that's pretty typical. I mean, you know,
right.
I mean, it's, you know, he... You
How
know.
Long does this last? I guess the question was something like this. We have, there's always some, you know, once a year or whatever, there's some brouhaha over a show or a news program, a drama, whatever it is, you know, Murphy Brown giving birth. I mean, who knows what it is or whatever, talking about, you know, smoking, whatever it winds up being, and advertisers expressing concern. I guess I wonder how lasting are these sorts of boycotts? Sorry, I can't quite speak.
I think by the time you get this story, you get the so-and-so is losing advertisers story, I think it's over at that point because that's the goal. These are usually vendettas by one group or another where they just keep hustling until they can declare victory by saying so-and-so is losing advertisers. And in this case, it sounds like maybe his show's losing advertisers, but certainly Fox News is not losing any revenues because there were two shows that shifted, according to the article, there were two shows that shifted and one was never supposed to be on Glenn's show to begin with. They just corrected an error, and the other was an intentional, we'll still buy ads, just don't put it on Glenn's show.
So they just so they kind of move it around,
right?
Or is he expected to do some sort of mea culpa?
It depends, you know, there's all different levels of gaffes, and the question is this a big enough one that he actually needs to explain? Or, you know, I haven't watched it, I don't know what he's been saying on the show. It could be that all the viewers know he meant something else, or maybe he really did mean it. I don't know. Well, it'll be interesting to see how it shakes out.
Great.
All right. Enough about that. Let's talk about books for a minute. A New York Times article about how Sony is adopting a common ebook format. And, you know, obviously ebooks are just becoming such an important topic in general.
Oh, these virtual goods you're talking about?
I guess
virtual
books? They are sort of digital books. Now, the Kindle has its own format. So I guess you can't really share that on, I mean, you could if Alex could, because he could hack anything. But I guess a lot of the other competitive e-readers are having their formats be much more open. And maybe that will help them gain market share. But it's not dissimilar to the music business with iTunes for the longest time kind of locking its formats and competitors having theirs open. And then everybody opens it. I don't know. I mean, does this... I just wonder, like, the whole idea of having an open format, does it spur... Will we see... I mean, will people actually buy the other devices? Or does the Kindle sort of become what the iPod is to music? Kind of the de facto player?
I still think there's one player coming.
Yeah, the tablet.
So the thing is that, you know, to me, I think
the iPad.
I'm waiting. You know, I really got close. I have to admit, I would have bought a Kindle in June when The Economist was being announced they're distributing, because that's one of the magazines I read, that I was going to get the DX, the Kindle DX. So I'm really interested in the PDF reading, the non-converting PDF reading, I think is the big thing, actually, on the DX. And I was going to go down that path, and then it got too close, and the rumors started getting too hectic with the Apple iPad, and I just pulled back and figured, I'm going to wait until January. And this is what I did with a phone. I had my Trio that I just dragged along until I could finally get the iPhone. And in the same way, I'm kind of backing off because I think that my problem is that I think that the Apple, what they're going to do, all these readers are fine, but I want color. I want video integrated. I want it to be, I don't want another device either. You know, I don't want, because I know I'm going to get the iPad or whatever they call it, the media pad or whatever they're going to call it.
Right.
I know I'm going to get that. And carrying that with the Kindle, with my iPhone, with my, you know, it's just like, I'm not going there.
You're doing that because you have a brand loyalty to Apple.
It's not brand loyal. Believe me, I will buy whatever.
Oh, dude, you have brand loyalty to Apple. Stop it. Don't even try to pretend.
No.
I will buy it because it's Apple.
I will literally buy whatever I think is the best thing out there. You know, and the thing is that no
which
one,
happens to be shiny. And okay, well, comes from really, Steve Jobs.
Okay, so do we really think that a BlackBerry is better than an iPhone?
For my purposes, yes, okay, a BlackBerry is better.
I'll try one.
A Kindle?
No, a BlackBerry. I'll get one. But I think that the Kindle, I think that it's going to be great, and I think it's going to do well. But I think that, you know, we're at the very beginning. It's kind of like the beginning of when we had all these MP3 players.
Right.
Everyone's jockeying for position. Everyone's trying to find their way in. Everyone's trying to get all that stuff worked out. And so, obviously, I think Sony has to do something intense to try to. Everyone's pushing for that. Everyone knows that we're not going to be printing books for. Right. 10 years from now.
Yeah, this is a halfway step, in my opinion. This is not like when iTunes announced that they were going to stop DRMing their music, or even when Amazon said, get all the MP3s non-DRM'd. There's still anti-copy protection in here. What we're doing is we're moving from one restrictive draconian DRM scheme to a slightly less restrictive draconian DRM screen, which is progress, but I'm still not super jazzed about it.
And I have to admit, I'm not totally. I don't know why I'm in such the like defending the man today, but I'm just in this mode
of because I'm beating up on the man.
I know. But I have to say that, you know, the DRM I think on books in some respects makes more sense than with video or other things, only because it is so easy to copy, and yes. it's a consumer market, and these files are so small, you know, that you could send it to every one of your friends without Comcast ever thinking about shaping your traffic, you know, because it's just, you know, and I think that's one of the other issues that you know, kind of related to that.
Tim, what are your thoughts on the whole ebook, EPUB, open formats?
Oh, I'm sorry. I've been on Turbo Squid looking at all their 3D models. Oh my gosh, that's a great site. You know, in terms of this, I mean, what as a consumer, what drives me crazy is that I can't buy one thing and have it work on any device. That drives me crazy. And I understand. I mean, you know, I drank the Apple Kool-Aid a long time ago, and I get it. But I'd like to buy stuff at Amazon now and know that it was going to work on whatever cool thing Apple came out with in September or January.
And that is true. At least this change does give people the confidence that they're not being locked into one specific device. But there still is problems with restrictive. And you know, there's problems.
I don't have
with,
to worry about the internet. It's like if I buy an Apple computer or a PC, the internet still works,
right?
At least for now. I'd like a book to be the same way.
Speaking of books, I'm going to be published.
Hey!
Congratulations!
Thank you,
man.
Crowd goes crazy.
I can't believe you were able to keep that quiet the whole time. I can't believe you sit down. Welcome to This Week in Media. I just got published. Yeah!
That's so awesome.
So I got a book deal last week. So as Brian knows, and many of you know, Alex and Tim and everyone, I've been striving for this for a very long time. And for all of you aspiring artists, writers, creators, whatever it is, you know, just keep pursuing it, because it wasn't my first novel. It wasn't my second. It wasn't my third. It was my fourth. So I wrote four novels, got a book deal for the fourth one, and it's a good deal. I have a two-book deal with Little Brown, and if you're not familiar with Little Brown, you will be right now, because they published James Patterson and Alice Siebold and David Sedaris and Twilight.
Nice.
So I'm very excited, because it's a great,
huge.
Great, great publishing house. So it's for my young adult novel.
And Jackman?
Sorry?
Is it about Hugh Jackman?
No.
That's what the first three were about. She finally figured out what the mistake was.
Nobody wants to read about Hugh Jackman. No, it's called The Mockingbirds, and it's about an underground student-run Justice League at a prestigious boarding school and how they kind of handle students you know, not doing nice things to other students. So, yeah. So, anyway. Ooh. So, there you go. So, I'm very excited. So, I will be sharing whatever I can share, if that's okay with my listeners and viewers. And
you know, what happens at the end?
Yeah.
Well, anyway. Oh, it's not coming out till 2010 or 2011, so it's still, you know, now it goes into the whole production process, but my editor is amazing. And but here's the thing, so I definitely want to, you know, use this forum to whatever degree is appropriate and people are interested to kind of share aspects of the publication process, because I announced it on, you know, Facebook and Twitter on Friday, and people said, please talk about it on Twitter, we want to hear about it. But also, I mean, we don't need to do this today because I'm going to wrap up the show, but I definitely want to get feedback from viewers and listeners on, you know, things I can do to promote it online as it gets closer. You know, right. I really want to just kind of tap into our collective knowledge. I feel fortunate here that I think, you know, one thing I can do with this is, you know, sort of marry my two worlds of, you know, the fiction and being able to write with being involved in the new media business and collaboration and knowing, you know, really creative, smart people, and figuring out, okay, what are some things that I can do to really kind of make this pop? You know, what are some cool online, you know, promotional things and websites and just, you know, all sorts of cool tie-ins. So if you guys will tolerate and permit that as the year goes on, I'm sorry?
When is the published date again?
Sometime in late 2010 or 2011. We're figuring it out. No, it's written. It's written. Shut up.
By the way, in the chat room, they want to know if you're going to read the audiobook version.
I know. That's what everybody was asking me. I got a lot of those last week on Facebook and Twitter. I got to talk to my agent about audio rights. I don't know. It's just like, just sell the book rights for now.
By the way, isn't that a great problem to have? It's like you're never the only time you have no problems is when you're dead. So the best you can hope for is to keep trading up for a more interesting set of problems.
Exactly.
And trying to decide who's going to read your audiobook version of your book is a good problem.
You know, it's funny. Awesome. I was walking my dog this morning, and I always try to, you know, I'm just going to be slightly metaphysical here. I always try to just like kind of calm my mind. Like when I was, because it's been a long process, you know. I mean, and this book is, it's just, it's been a long process, and that's all I'm going to say.
Long and painful.
I would always, when I walk my dog in the morning, that would be my time where I would just kind of just try to calm my brain down and just, you know, focus on the positive, you know, just whatever, that sort of positive thinking, visualization, all that, and just kind of put myself in the right frame of mind so I didn't go crazy every single day, you know, just as hoping for something and it not happening or whatever. So I'm walking my dog this morning. I'm like, oh God, how do I have to calm my mind today? Or what's the next thing to start?
There's nothing to think anymore.
Right? Now I have to think about the next thing. And I guess maybe that'll be how to make it an awesome success, how to make it a bestseller. So.
Isn't it funny how like the moment you have a massive success like that, it takes about 20 seconds before you're like, all right, what's next?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
That's what you have to think about. So, that's my news, and I'm happy to share it with all of you. So thank you. I know everyone has been supportive in their own ways and just, you know, encouraging, and whether it's via email or social networking or, you know, just folks I know in person like you guys. So thank you all.
Hooray, Daisy.
All right. And I guess on that note, we'll wrap up the show. So where can people find you, Brian?
Oh, you can follow me. You could see the show at scamschool.tv. We're up to episode 75, comes out this week. I can't believe we're already that high. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Schwood. That's at S-H-W-O-O-D. Excellent. That's the last part
and
of Brushwood.
And tonight...
Tonight at 21st Amendment.
August 17th. Okay. Yes. It's going to come out later on iTunes, so you'll have missed it. So if you're watching live today, go live today. Alex.
They can find me on the Twitters.
At Alex Lindsay.
Alex Lindsay, all one word.
I always have to say that for you.
Well, because it's AY. And here's the thing. He's like, it's a house of cards. Twitter's coming down.
Well, find me there.
Part of it is, I think after I've started to say that, it's interesting that you can't search for Alex Lindsay and find me on Twitter. You have to actually type the name in. I don't know why. I think it's a Twitter conspiracy.
Yeah, because of what you just said.
Well,
Tim.
No, it happened before that. That's why I said it.
Because they knew.
OneTimStreet.com and on Twitter, OneTimStreet.
Excellent. And you can find me at daisywhitney.com. We are over and out.